And that jarring cacophony tells you that you're back with the podcast that likes to look at Doctor Who things, discuss them, discourse them, digest them, and occasionally we'll disagree about them. But more often than not, we're always very, very nice about them. I'm Kenny Smith. I'm joined tonight by my friend, my co-conspirator, and a man who's got a lovely background to him as we speak with the setting sun on the Clyde coast. It's Dr. John Bolan.
Hello. Thanks, Kenny. I can actually see the back of my head reflected in the window as well. So I'm seeing grey highlights and an infinite regression of Zoom screens. So I feel a bit dizzy.
Oh, my goodness. Is that a recursive occlusion?
It is indeed. Go you. Oh. Yeah, we're getting all very Castrovalvan.
Oh, it is.
Is that Castrovalva?
I can't remember. It is.
Is it? Yeah, okay.
Castrovalva also is the wonderful quote about a library, what with books and stuff. A phrase that I regularly use, but nobody gets it, so I just think it's obscure and funny, to my mind anyway.
Indeed.
But it's lovely to have you back, John. It's been a wee while since we've seen you, but you have been super busy, of course.
And my fees are enormous, so you really can't afford me regularly.
Yeah, that's why we're getting two for one as we record, but people will find out what the other recording was in the near future. But yeah, we're going for a Big Finish Companion Chronicle today. It's a story where the author has never spoken before in public to a Doctor Who podcast. And if people want to talk to a Doctor Who podcast for the first time about the Big Finish work, chances are they're going to come on The Power of Three.
Where else would they go? Come on.
Well, there's the Sirens of Audio who are bloody good, but we've got Patrick first. So sorry to the guys. We've got him here.
We've got him locked in a cupboard.
We have. So. We've been making him write poetry till it bleeds out of his eyes. But we'll come back to that later. Yes, we're talking about Patrick Chapman and Fear of the Daleks. Of course, Fear of the Daleks was the second story in the first series of Companion Chronicles from Big Finish. It was written by Patrick Chapman, narrated by Wendy Padbury and Nicholas Briggs, with the Second Doctor, Jamie and Zoe, and it was released on the 9th of February 2007. So, having a quick look at the back cover blurb, it tells us, why has Zoe Harriet been having nightmares about the Daleks? Who is the Doctor? A mysterious man from her past. When an evil scientist hijacks her mind to control a galaxy-conquering weapon, Zoe must stop him. First, she and the Second Doctor will face an enemy they had thought destroyed forever. So it's quite a fun one, isn't it? Sort of discovering this Companion Chronicles format, because this is obviously still finding their feet, being the very first batch.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't listened to a huge number of the Companion Chronicles, and so when I listened to this, it was, you know, well out of sync. So I wasn't really aware of where this particular story sat in the development of the genre, if I can say that, on a Friday evening. So yeah, I was interested that it was Zoe that we got. I mean, how much had Zoe or Wendy done for Big Finish at this point? Can you remember the top of your head?
She'd done Davros, where she played another character, Lorraine Baines. And I think she might, gosh, had she done a Sixth Doctor trilogy with Jamie when they rejoined him after In the Land of Fiction? I'm not too sure. But yeah, she'd done a little bit, but not a huge amount. And,
yeah.
Shall we actually, why don't we pop on the trailer just now and we'll have a quick listen to that.
Okay.
Who are you? Who are you? Answer!
There have always been the dreams. Always the dreams. I don't remember how long I've been having them. Years, it seems. Decades, perhaps. They start with the same voices. Chilling, inhuman, almost pure evil.
Exterminate!
Those voices end in the same heart-rending sound of destruction, as though the universe is tearing itself apart. Then I see a fragment of something elusive, an action, a face. And I wake up with a cry. The dreams have been getting more lucid recently. I've been seeing more of the faces, the actions. And I think I finally have something coherent, which is why I've come to you, Counselor. I have an eidetic memory. Clarity, precision, almost reality. Imagine dreaming of monsters when you have a gift such as mine.
That's a good trailer. I would buy it if I had not already bought it.
Me too. The good thing about Wendy's voice is that she's still recognisably herself, or when she's playing Zoe. You know, her voice really hasn't changed all that much, which is remarkable considering how long it's been, you know, well over 50 years.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and it was nice. I've got a lot of affection for the character of Zoe, and it was interesting to see this adventure, or to hear this adventure, because it reminded me of how terribly sad her departure was. I mean, that, you know, that bit at the end of the War Games where, you know, she just, you sort of see her sort of thinking, struggling to remember, and then dismissing it as that is nothing, you know. And I thought, it's so sad, you know, one of the saddest departures of a companion. I think it's even more poignant than Jamie, because you just see Jamie getting up and running off and getting, you know, picking up where he left off. But there's just this kind of sense of loss, that she's not, you know, she hasn't entirely lost this something that she's lost, but she doesn't know what it is. And that's why I think this is a really good narrative vehicle, this thing about therapy and her, you know, having these intrusive memories, we might call them, I don't know. But for someone like me who spends a lot of his time involved in therapeutic conversations, I thought this was a really clever way to do it. And it kind of does, it honours that moment at the end of the War Games. And I think also is true as well to the first time we encounter Zoe in the wheel in space, that she talks about, you know, being trained or doing something anyway in the sort of parapsychology unit. And you can imagine that involves all sorts of mind-bending experiments, and how that also might have laid the groundwork for this, you know, this kind of outpouring of memory. You know, there's something quite different about Zoe's mind and brain and memory that maybe even the Time Lords didn't reckon on.
No, that's great. I mean, that's why I thought you'd be a great one to chat about this one with, because obviously with your professional line of work, because I think that it's something that Big Finish come back to later on and examine more of Zoe. There's a sort of an ongoing arc further down the line where Zoe's been questioned by the company as they try to find out a particular detail about her travels with the Doctor and Jamie. And as far as it's a really good arc, it's worth having a look for if it's in the sale. But no, I think it's a great story. I think because Wendy's just so strong, as you say, her voice is very much, you know exactly who it is, whereas some companions, for example, Katie Manning's voices have aged a lot more. And you know exactly who this is. Maureen O'Brien's another one whose voice hasn't changed in the slightest. The way she can pitch up and find Vicky's again, amazing. But no, I enjoy this, and I love the fact that it's a slightly different Dalek plot. It's not the usual go out, all out assault that we were used to in the 60s here. It's sort of with that crystalline element, which I find quite fascinating, and using these crystals to try and get by the defences and take over that way, divide and conquer.
To an extent, it's an unusual way to use the Daleks, I guess it's in keeping, I suppose, with the overall arc of what was going on in the evil of the Daleks, and that, you know, we'd supposedly seen the last of them. But it struck me that, you know, apart from the fact they're in the title, you didn't really need to have Daleks in this. This could easily have been another completely different enemy, if we even say the Daleks are the enemy in this. But yeah, it could have been any number or a brand new sort of creation. So I just thought it was an interesting choice to have the Daleks, especially, as I said, purists might kind of quibble about it muddying the waters or messing up with the timeline. Although Zoe does have a kind of a, on screen, she has a visceral reaction to the Daleks when the Doctor shows her the Daleks, that, you know, so presumably they're also coded somewhere in her cultural and historical memory.
Yeah.
I don't know how the timeline works. I mean, she's supposed to be the end of the 21st century, isn't she?
Something like that, yeah. This is with the wheel and it's
such. Very timey-wimey.
Very. But I do like the, you know, the cultures that are created with the Xanthans and the Tabari and the city on an asteroid. I quite like that, sort of that imagery of it, a city covered by a protective dome. And I do like that. The fact that there's the Tabari being a race of fish-like aliens who originated in Earth, which they make mention of. And what a great name, Professor Atrica. That's such a 60s-sounding name as well.
Yeah, indeed, indeed.
Yeah. Well, we've had a wee chat about it. Why don't we hear from the author, as I said, doing his Doctor Who podcast debut?
Hi, my name's Patrick Chapman, and I wrote Fear of the Daleks, which I believe was the second companion chronicle for Big Finish.
So it's one that is back in the annals of history.
The first four companion chronicles came out in 2007 in February, and they were produced the year before. And the one I wrote, Fear of the Daleks, I wrote during the summer autumn of 2006, and then it was recorded later that year. I think it was in the Moat, but I'm not sure.
Nasty. Now, I think it'd be fair to say that as we're chatting just now and we were saying beforehand, there's a few sci-fi things behind you. There's an Enterprise, there's Liberators, there's an Eagle, and of course there's a TARDIS and a Dalek and a Weeping Angel. So when did your love of science fiction, and of course in particular Doctor Who, begin?
Well, one of my earliest memories is John Pertwee stumbling out of the police box in the woods, Spearhead from Space. Now, I know it was the original broadcast because I remember it being in black and white and we didn't have a colour telly. And it was the first one broadcast in colour, of course. So I was approximately 2 years old. I later discovered that I'd been born during episode 3 of The Dominators, which features the same TARDIS team that was in Fear of the Daleks. So that's just a coincidence. But growing up, I was in love with Star Trek from a young age, the Captain Kirk iteration, and that was even before the animated Star Trek started. But Doctor Who was the main thing, and I basically, Tom Baker became my doctor. I remember all of the Pertwees, but Baker onwards was the golden age for me as a child. And then, of course, in 78, Blake 7 came along, and I became obsessed with that. And Doctor Who as well, bubbling away in the background. But for some reason, Blake 7 inspired me to do my own fan fiction at the age of 9 or whatever it was, or 10. And my first published work was fan fiction for Blake 7 in the LPF, Liberator Popular Front, Freedom Party Services. I think Jason Hay Ellery was in that. And so that's it. It all leads back to Doctor Who and Blake 7, really.
That's brilliant. I think it's one of those things that everybody sort of a certain age, I think, something you just sort of tap into, particularly with obviously the way that Star Wars had that boom in the late 70s to hook us all in, which is fantastic. Maybe tell us a wee bit about your professional career, of course, because words are a way in which you make your living.
That's right. Well, I got into writing by mistake, as Withnail might say, or because I thought copywriting meant writing. So when I left school, I did a course in copywriting in a college in Dublin and started working as an advertising writer. But that was an excuse to pay the bills so I could work on a poetry collection. And the poetry came out in 1991. And it all sort of stopped immediately because poetry books don't sell. and I just kept plugging away in the background, and then another book came out, and then eventually I did some stories. So it all blossomed from that point. And I still do both today. I write scripts and poems and advertising gigs as well.
Something I've always wondered about is, I mean, obviously I know what the UK Doctor Who fan seems like. So what was it like in Ireland?
Yeah, well, there's a thing. During the recording of Fear of the Daleks, Nicholas Briggs turned to me and said, "So, are you one of us, as it were, you know, a big fan, a huge dyed-in-the-wool?" And I didn't quite know what to say to that, because I hadn't been to the Fitzroy Tavern, or whatever it was called, because I lived in Ireland. And some people think, or I've read some places, that in Ireland they didn't get the BBC, therefore they couldn't have seen Doctor Who. But of course we got it from BBC Northern Ireland, it seeped over. And so we watched all of it all the time. Growing up, it wasn't such a big thing. There was no concept of fandom as it would have been known in the UK. Because there was no internet, the connections between countries were by paper only sort of thing, and television. So people wouldn't see it as strange to be into Doctor Who or a niche thing. Everyone played Daleks in the playground. And it was just a thing that people talked about. But those who took it extremely seriously, I didn't meet any of them. I mean, I took it ever as seriously as, you know, I loved it to bits, but I wasn't joining anyone in the pub at 9 years old to discuss it.
Interesting. It's just fascinating because one of my good friends, Johnny Candon, he's like yourself, he lives in Dublin and he's a big fan. And I just wondered, you know, if there was something similar, because in Glasgow, we used to go to the pub on a Saturday night with the group, and we'd, you know, talk about the new adventures and then Big Finish stuff when that came along later on in the 90s. So we made our own community, and I just wondered if something similar.
It was lovely to see that happening as well after the show went off the air, because the ownership in a nice way that fans took of the story gave it a sort of life that I think it needed before it came back again, because without that, the roots of the return are in that fandom, I think. That's clear from the people who made the show in 2003 and 5. You know, they were all new adventures people.
Let's skip forward. We've talked about, you mentioned new adventures. I just mentioned Big Finish. How did the commission for Fear of the Daleks come about? Because it was one of those ones that's like, oh, a new range. This is exciting. And it must have been exciting for you to be involved in that, especially.
It was. It came about because Mark J. Thompson, who was the director of the range, a few years earlier, I'd been looking for a copywriting work because I'd gone freelance. And I looked around on this newfangled internet thing and said, oh, look, there's somebody who might need a writer. So I got in touch. And a couple of years later, he said he was doing this range of audio CDs called The Actor Speaks. And he knew I was a poet. So he asked if he could have a poem for Louise Jameson to read. And I said, great. And I sent him a poem. And she asked to change the person of, or the voice of the narrator to a female voice for her. So I said, yeah, great. So I tweaked it a bit. And that came out in his range. I think Jacqueline Pierce and Gareth Thomas and Paul Darrow were on that range as well. They were great listens, those. And then a couple of years after that, I think it was, he said, this new thing is coming. Would you like to do one? And I went, yes, of course. You know, because it's amazing. I had liked the Big Finishes before. I think Paul McGann's Shadow was the first one I heard. And that was, you know, only a few years previous, because Big Finish, I guess everyone knows how long it's been going now, but it wasn't going that long at the time compared to how long it is now. So it was a very exciting development, because it was the first time you could get adventures of the first to fourth Doctors on audio regularly anyway, because, you know, the three of them weren't available for a good reason. They were all dead and Tom Baker wasn't having any of it. How things have changed, but it was a very exciting new venture.
What do you recall about what was in your brief from Mark?
The brief was, you have the Daleks, you have Zoe, and come up with something. That was it, really. It was like, write a treatment. And so I did, and then that got feedback from the BBC and from Big Finish, and then I rewrote it again. So it was the usual process where you throw some ideas at the, you know, sends us some ideas in and they come back and say, we like this, we like that, change this. Could we can't call the character that because it's too similar to somebody from 1978 and so on. So it was the usual, very fruitful, I thought, collaboration in terms of getting the story just right before the script was even written, a word of the script was written.
I suppose that's a bit of a badge of honour, sort of like, okay, give us your first audio script for Big Finish, and you've got Daleks. No pressure.
Yeah, I know. It was no pressure. But the Daleks were always there in my head anyway. So it was a thrill and an honour, and knowing that Nick Briggs would be doing it as well, because I'd been a fan of his work on the show as well. That was a thrill as well. So, and the weird thing is, it all seemed to go rather smoothly in the script writing process, as it does. And then at the end of it, I got invited to go to the studio to hear it being recorded. And I was like, wow, okay, I'm going to do that as well. So it was one, I guess, one privilege after another, really.
Do you remember many changes during the scripting process? Because, I mean, I love the whole thing with the crystals. I think it's a lovely concept, and which is reflected in the musical score as well. This is sort of like a crystalline kind of sound in there.
Yeah. Well, it was... It became shorter, because that's what happens, because they realized, oh, we've got 66 minutes or whatever. It was a much longer script. And I think it improved by being tightened. And it was cut into two episodes, because that's how Doctor Who was back then, in terms of, I think that's how Big Finish does it. You know, the length of the episode reflects the old show, the classic series. So the structure of it came to me sometime early on, because I knew that Zoe wouldn't remember what had happened, or couldn't remember what had happened, but she'd have these dreams, so you can't suppress something that's been wiped from your mind. So it had to be in her subconscious. So I thought it would make it from her point of view as she is today, or the present moment of the drama, not the Zoe from the 60s. So she would be, we'd be seeing it through her eyes, and therefore that tied in with Wendy Padbury narrating the whole thing. And therefore she'd probably not see much of Jamie, and she'd see more of the Doctor, and there'd be more of Wendy. So I was conscious that we only had Wendy, so I played to her, you know.
I think it's a great concept, just with the Daleks, with their using their puppets to get their own way, as usual. And it's very much in that classic mold. And of course, you pick up pretty much straight after the end of the repeat of The Evil with Daleks.
That's right, yeah.
It's quite a nice touch, that acknowledging. And of course, now we've got The Evil of the Daleks novelization, the repeat being novelized from Jamie's point of view.
So that's a lovely idea as well, isn't it? That the repeat is being novelized.
It's just such
that reminds me of Shada a bit, you know?
Yeah. Only Doctor Who could do that, novelize a repeat.
I know. Yeah. It's one of those things that even post-Chibnall era, the continuity is so scrambled, and that's so brilliant, that everything counts.
Yes, you can explain away everything and anything.
I'm sure this wasn't the case, but, you know, Stephen Moffat probably created the cracks in time, so Big Finish might be able to fill it someday.
With story polyfiller.
Yeah, story polyfiller.
How did you enjoy creating alien races as well, and the fact that, are you a fan of fish?
I was thinking of that when the Hath came up. I said, hold on a sec. And then I realized, well, they've done fish people before a lot, you know. So yeah, I'm a fan of fish people. But the reptilian and mammalian biology doesn't quite fit. And yet, you know, evolution can do weird things.
That's it. And do you like cinnamon as well?
Yes. Cinnamon fish. I thought, let's be incongruous here.
Oh, I was in, when I was on holiday in Lanzarote, I discovered creme catalan, which is effectively a version of Bailey's, but with a hint of cinnamon to it. So it's rather nice, but I'll stick to my original Bailey's. Thank you very much.
Yeah, okay. That was invented in 1970-something in London by a marketing crew who said, let's make an Irish product. What'll we call it? And the restaurant they were working above was called Bailey's. So they gave it that name. It's not a historical Irish product at all, but it made me think, when you just said that, mind working. the Chula warship, where the people writing Doctor Who were named it after the restaurant they used to go to.
I had no idea. I'm sorry, I'm just gobsmacked here. I had no idea that Bailey's was a modern invention. I'd always thought it was a traditional Irish product, and I had been lied to.
You've been lied to very cleverly by very clever people who do lying for a business.
These blooming people who work with words for a living, what are they like?
Yes, indeed. The sophistry is terrible.
Let's skip forward to the shoot recording, since you mentioned you were there. That must have been a real delight. You mentioned, obviously, it was lovely to meet Nick, having been a fan. And then, of course, there's the lovely Wendy, who's just one of the most warm, funny, lovely human beings out there.
Yeah. I didn't really do much in the studio, as I wasn't expecting to. I sat on the couch and just absorbed it all and watched it happening. And I'm familiar with recording studios anyway through my other job, so I just knew what was going on, and it was nice to watch them at work. And she was very warm and friendly, and Mark was lovely to work with, and Nick was lovely to work with. And there was it was a kind of an interesting moment, because I just saw this being made, and I'd never seen anything Doctor Who being made before. And the fact that I'd written, well, it didn't really come into my mind. It was like, until I realized, oh my God, the Daleks are saying something what I wrote. And that was a thrill as well. So it was all very excellent to do. And then I sort of thought, maybe I shouldn't be here, because I'm not sure if the Big Finish policy is you shouldn't have writers in the room, or what's the protocol here, because Mark had, I'd asked him if I could, and he said, yeah, sure. But I didn't know if then, but then I was made feel so welcome anyway, that it was lovely.
Yeah, it's great. It's always good atmosphere. I've only been at two recordings and been made very welcome at both. So
yeah,
one was a First Doctor story, and one was an Eighth Doctor story. It was good fun times. I suppose there must have been that real thrill when you hear Nick saying those words, and particularly when you got the variation of "my vision is impaired."
Yeah, I mean, I threw that in as a joke, and then you see a review going, well, thinking can't be impaired because they're able to speak. And I go, yeah, the windows are the wrong size. So I thought that's fandom, a certain kind of, but yeah, my vision is impaired, or my brain is impaired. That was lovely to hear him say that.
It's wonderful, because I have to admit, I re-listened to it on my way into work this morning, and I was just chuckling away when I heard that. It still makes me laugh, and it brought a wee giggle to my face. So of course, this was in studio in 2006, released in 2007. So yeah. What was your feeling when you were first told it was available and you could listen to it?
Delighted that it was out there, and I'd heard edits, so I knew what was coming up. I had heard edits of some of it, and to hear it all completed with all the music and everything, and the sound effects, and that really lifted it. You know, I wrote an asteroid with a city on it, but I didn't create it in the sense that the other people, the sound design was superb, I thought, and the pacing was all right for me, and it was episode-like pacing. So it wasn't hugely fast or anything, but that was okay for the period. And I just thought they got it very right.
Yeah, because now, I did mention to you before we started that I'd got some interesting facts for you. Now, you mentioned there that the music and sound design, that was done by Lawrence Oakley. And since working for Big Finish, and I was absolutely flabbergasted when I looked this up, he has gone on to work on a host of TV productions, including the quiz show Bridge of Lies, Antiques Road Trip, Saturday Kitchen Live, Robot Wars, and even did work on the official Thronecast, the Game of Thrones podcast. So that's not a bad person to have had working on your production.
Yeah. It's quite indicative, I think, of the quality of people that Big Finish get to work with them, because people see what they're doing and go, I want to be part of that. And that's great. You know, it's clear that they have the respect of everyone who, you know, that level of talent. Well, just look at the list of people who do. So it's no surprise that Lawrence went on to do all of that, because he's really, you know, he was really great for Fear of the Daleks.
Yeah. Of course, the Companion Chronicles went on to run for 8 series and then continued with 4 box sets afterwards. So how does it feel to know that you were part of creating something that was a hugely popular range in its time? And of course, getting that era, that lost era, back to life on audio with the Second Doctor?
Well, it was an experiment at the time for Big Finish. And it was one of those little acorns out of which mighty oaks grow, because it was a very clever way of getting the first four Doctors in. I think it may have led to Tom Baker coming back because of how everything grew. And it started, I think, the Fear of the Daleks started Wendy's return, because I think other writers have expanded on that thread. And that's a good thing to know. You know, it's lovely to feel part of that.
Fantastic. So can you tell us maybe a wee bit about some of your work and where people can find it as well, for those who are interested to find out what you've done beyond the TARDIS?
I've written a lot of work for B7 Media. I did Dan Dare for them, and with some great people as well, Curtian Doyle, Colin Brake, Mark Platt, and others. Let's see, I also worked on, in a production capacity, on The Martian Chronicles, which came out with Big Finish as well. B7 produced that for Radio 4. And written a few poetry books. You can get those at salmonpoetry.com. And a novel or two, well, short stories as well. So from Blazevox. So there's I did a lot of telly as well, strangely enough, for children. Who knew I could do that? Well, somebody asks you and you go and do it, and then, oh, look, I can do that. And then other people ask you. That's how it works, I suppose. Garth and Bev and Wildernuts, stuff that was on CBeebies, and some stuff that was in Australia as well. So that was nice.
It's rather nice to hear that you've been keeping yourself busy, and it's good to know that you have a writing life beyond Doctor Who, which quite a lot of people tend not to realise. Obviously, I know this because I have been following you on Twitter for a good wee while, but it's always nice to let people know what else you can do and where they can go and find out, and hopefully make a purchase or two.
Yes, that'd be lovely.
The Dan Dare stuff was great. I really loved that as somebody. I mean, I grew up with the Dan Dare Eagle of the 80s.
Yeah,
you know, somewhere with the 50s, the original, and somewhere with the 70s, 2000 AD version. But for me, it was the 80s is my Dan Dare, but I love it.
I first met the character in 2000 AD, issue one, and it was a sort of 70s punk Dan Dare, and then it went off into very strange territory altogether. And then they went back to basics with the Eagle reboot in 82-ish, was it, right?
Yep.
Then? With his grandson, I think, and the same old Mekon.
Of course, he's the same with his villainous suits, and brilliantly brought to life in audio as well.
Yeah.
I would hugely recommend, if anybody hasn't heard them, go out and listen to them, buy them. Definitely buy them. Don't be evil. We don't support down the people who rob stuff on this podcast. Go and buy it. I enjoy it.
Yeah. Because, I mean, like, you see people saying, boasting about, well, I never pay for anything. Well, then how are you going to get stuff made?
Exactly. The death of creativity. So people like that, if anybody like that's listening to this podcast, they can just go away, because we don't want that sort of listener. We want people to pay their legit money for it. Exactly. So Patrick, you've told us about Fear of the Daleks. So could you maybe tell us a bit about your new book that's on the way soon, the following year?
Yes, it's a poetry collection. I think it's my 10th. That's not a boast, it's just apology. That's coming out in May. May the 10th, I think, is the launch of it. And it's sort of a bunch of poems I wrote over the period of the last 4 years or so. And a lot of it seemed to go backwards into my past and childhood memories. And some of those turned to memories of Doctor Who and Blake 7 and other TV shows of the time, which became images for memory in general. So the things you remember from your childhood, it's as valid to have it as remembering a Chris Boucher item from Image of the Fendal. There's a poem called Wanda Ventum's Eyes in there, as any other kind of image. So it became an exploration of that, really.
It's very moving, because obviously having you kindly having sent me a PDF of it earlier to have a look through. and there's a lot of emotion. It's very, very personal. I can tell you've put an awful lot of your heart and soul in there. As you say, it's writings over a number of years going back to your childhood, and even from the word go with darling, it is known that a never living child will haunt the tenant, not the house. That is just, it's so moving, sort of like, think about it. And I just read that and went back over that 3 or 4 times and thought, that's absolutely true. There's just so much to think about in that sentence, in that couple of sentences.
Yeah, that's one of the things. If you go through memory as a theme, it's coupled all with grief, usually. Sometimes unprocessed and sometimes processed. And that poem popped up into my head very quickly as the idea that you're never, it isn't where you live that shapes who you are, it's yourself. You carry yourself with you everywhere you go.
Very much so. And then, of course, you flagged up a few poems for me to have a look at. Cathode Rays, which was not what I expected at all. And because I was thinking, oh, this will be some sort of Blake Seven Doctor Who centric poem, but then read it and the fact that you've got mentions of things like the IRA and kid-gloved hitman raises his gun and then just mentions of Gouda Prime, Caligula, and just incredibly, incredibly moving and sort of bringing together real life and fantasy and the horror of, and pretty much obviously the Gouda Prime reference to cold-blooded murder.
Absolutely, but also Quatermass, the John Mills version is in there with...
Yes, Bernard.
City ...helping Bernard and stop the harvest. The aliens are harvesting humans, so he presses the, spoiler alert, nuclear bomb. And that was freaky when I was a kid. And so was the Caligula, John Hurt ripping... I saw it again as an adult, John Hurt ripping a fetus out of his sister, which is what that is, you know, Caligula in I, Claudius. And then there's this image of the hitman shooting somebody who lifts a newspaper up in front of her head. And I've never been able to remember what show that was from, but the image stayed with me. So there's all sorts of, when you're a child, you're open to everything, I think, and the impression that's made on you as a young person can be quite strong, because there's not as much in your head as there will be later on. So whatever goes in there really makes an impact.
Yeah. Oh, there is. I mean, even just, you know, simple lines like at the last line of day one, you called yourself the boy who murdered God. And just think, what? That is just the impact of that, just that line in its own. Wow.
Well, that's true as well. They did say stuff like that. And as an adult, like early on in that poem, they say, IHS, was it? Mm. I have suffered. But in fact, it's Jesus, King of the Jews. You know, it's a mocking. Day one, by the way, for listeners, is about learning religion in school as a child. And they tell you all sorts of things like, you know, you're going to burn in hell, you're responsible. And if you're taking that stuff seriously, the logical conclusion is you actually did kill God. And from my current grown-up atheist perspective, that's kind of shocking.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And we have to talk about Wand of Enfam Eyes, which as soon as I saw the name of that, I'm singing it to the tune of Betty Davis Eyes.
Yeah, I do that too sometimes, having written that line. But that was Image of the Fendal, which stayed with me as well. And then you look back and you go, oh, she's got painted eyes. That was all right. And you don't see the artifice of it when you're a kid. And especially if you saw it, as I did at the time, on a very small TV that was possibly black and white. So the imagery of it isn't dependent on what you see on the screen, it's what happens in your mind's eye. So that really struck me, that idea of the creature made of a core and 12 disciples, that again ties in with the religion thing, because it took me, maybe this was intentional on the part of Chris Boucher, but it brought me back to the religion I was brought up in and the apostles and so on. You know, well, that's a coincidence. So I thought I'd use a bit of that to slag them off again. But the power of that image is very strong still, you know?
Mm-hmm. Particularly when you think about it, it's almost the, when she's standing there with her arms open, it's that messianic sort of pose. Yeah.
And she's even wearing clothes that you'd expect Jesus to wear. You know?
Yeah.
Not the hairstyle, obviously, but
far too glam. Far
and then
too glam.
I saw UFO as an adult and I realized, Virginia Lake. Sorry, Virginia Lake, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yes, Colonel Lake, yeah. Or Benedict's mum.
Benedict's mum, yeah. So that's kind of interesting. But yeah, that poem, there are many poems in the book that are related to that. Mm-hmm. But a lot of it is seen from an adult perspective where you realize how A, troubling some of it was, and B, ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And just made up, you know, so.
Yeah. One that completely threw me was, just going by the title, I thought, I need to read this, We Are the Martians, which was making me think, that's going to be some sort of Quatermass allegory. But no.
No, it's not. It's Ray Bradbury looking at the Martians who, the humans who arrive at the end of the book in the Martian Chronicles, look into the lake, and they're the last humans, but now they're on Mars, and they're looking into the lake and saying, we are the Martians. And then I thought the idea of, this was a COVID poem, basically, and a virus going around the world, and the idea that humans may have unleashed this, we're the invaders on our planet. So that's where that reference ties in, really.
And then finally, in terms of a sci-fi reference, and we chat about condensation when there's lines Farscape Galactica, Blake.
Yeah, but it's like your favourite operas, and you expect Puccini, but in fact it's space operas. And then at the end, Servalan, you know, a terminal.
Yes.
Some person watching telly or watching a DVD, probably, because it's about how alone you can be in your life and nobody will notice because you're living alone and you just have these things for company. So at the end of the poem, it's revealed that it's taking place at Christmas, which I think gives you a bit of an extra kick, I'd hope. But partly it's inspired by waking up out of a period of depression and realizing you've got to deal with the detritus of it, or the leavings of it. When you look behind you and you go, there's a big scar back there I've just made in the world, or in my own world, and I'm alone here. And then you have to find a way of making sense of that. But also it then reminded me of the brilliant documentary by Carol Morley, Dreams of a Life, which featured the story of a woman in London, I think it was London, who lived alone, having left her life, their recognizable life, and she was found in her flat three years after she'd died. And the reason she was found was that the electricity had run out and people came looking for her money. She had paid everything by direct debit, so nobody bothered her as long as she was paying. And I thought that was another image to describe the society we all live in at the moment. If you're paying, nobody cares what you do. And if you stop paying, suddenly they'll notice. So the idea that human value, the value of a human being, is calculated financially tells us about the time we live in, I think.
I can relate to that because my aunt passed away last year. In fact, no, 2 years ago. Oh, yes, last year, having spent a year in hospital. And then all of a sudden, the letters started appearing from Scottish Power. Mm-hmm. And the likes sort of say, you haven't paid your bill.
Yeah.
You still haven't paid your bill. Mm-hmm. And just these, it was just, the tone of them was becoming increasingly horrible. So yes, I can completely relate to that.
Hostility of it as well.
Yes, it's the tone and the threatening tone. Sort of, we're sending somebody round to install a meter when there's been no reply, and there's no thought to think, why would somebody who's always paid not be replying?
The idea is also that there's no such thing as official empathy. It's all about the mechanism of society and how it is kept running. We're living in Brazil, you know, the movie Brazil. And even in Ireland, I see it particularly in Britain at the moment, which seems to be turning into a less friendly place, shall we say. But even in Ireland, it's like this up to a point. In fact, it is like that. There's a whole official societal, I said the word mechanism, I think that's appropriate, that doesn't care about the individual and never has really. And it's just different people take the levers every so often, and what they used to call the little guy gets crushed, but individual people don't matter as long as they keep doing stuff that they're expected to do. It occurred to me with all of the online world as well, the point of culture often isn't that you buy or you read the book you bought, it's that you bought the book.
Mm-hmm.
So nobody cares about proofreading anymore.
Yeah.
So I think we need to slow down and back away from all of that, but it's possible that it may not happen.
Yeah, I know what you mean about the... What was the... There is no such thing as society, the Thatcher quote. But there's a wonderful example that sort of stands out against that in Glasgow, I think it was just before the pandemic, there was a gentleman who was going to be removed for having overstayed his visa, and they were trying to remove him, or he hadn't been granted asylum, and he was living in a community in Glasgow, and the people heard about this and they knew that the police were going to be attending, so literally thousands of people blocked streets so the police van couldn't get through, and the gentleman in question had his status reevaluated and he was allowed to stay. And that just shows the power that there still is that there in communities, and it's very moving to know that people will still stand up for what's right.
I think that's brilliant, and that's where the change will happen, is that people themselves individually make decisions that connect with other people. And it's easy, as I often am, to be cynical about the whole thing, but you have to remember where the world is cyclical and there's always a reaction to what's going on. And it always gets pushed away into the other direction. I mean, people turning up to the vote in Russia today, even though they might be arrested, thousands of them supporting Navalny. Not that he was any angel, but he was better than the alternative. And just an expression that we don't agree with you. That's often the start of something beautiful that changes the world.
Yeah, we can but hope. My other hope is that when somebody's reading Condensation, they'll come to the last line and think, what on earth is a servalan?
I know, I was thinking, I'm not going to explain that, and I will let them Google it.
Yes, I think that really made me laugh. It's funny because sort of throwing some light on something that's a very dark subject matter, but then just to have that in is sort of, there's a very dark humour in there, and I like that, Mr. Chapman. Yeah.
And wait till they find out what a terminal is.
So yeah.
It changed shape between seasons 3 and 4, didn't it?
Yes, from a circular round planet to a squashed egg. So it must have been the pressures of space pressure, as Terry Nation would probably describe it.
It went the other way. It turned into a round planet.
That's it. Yes, it's been... The pressure's forced
it. Well, you're looking at it edge-on in season 4, so it's all right.
Yep. Thank you so much for coming on for your first ever Doctor Who podcast chat.
Thank you, Kenny. It's been great to be here talking to you.
Huge thanks to Patrick, and his new book is available to pre-order, and you can find out more at www.salmonpoetry.com. That's SalmonPoetry. Kind of appropriate considering there's like space fish in this story. So yes, that does seem appropriate. And the full links will be in the program notes as well. So yeah, I think it's an enjoyable story considering like the range is finding its feet. And Nick Briggs, as always, does a great job with the Daleks, just capturing that 60s sound with a bit of an extra harsh rasp in there.
Bit of a Hawkins effect.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very enjoyable. But yeah, I'd say it's finding its feet, and it's, you know, it's a writer who's, obviously you can tell that Patrick's a big Doctor Who fan, and I've enjoyed that, and his other works are well worth taking a look into his poetry, particularly his new book with all these sci-fi references in it. So yeah, go out and have a look. We've given you the details there. So there we go.
I will do, boss.
Sounds good to me. So John, I'm going to ask you a question today.
Gosh, will I know the answer?
I don't know, but it's up to you. We always like to play out the tune. So John, did you have any choices that you'd like to play out with that's related to the story in some way?
So, now that you've posed me that question, Kenny, and as we're talking about fear of the Daleks, why don't we go for something to do with fear or fears? So why don't we hit upon Tears for Fears with their anthemic hit, Everybody Wants to Rule the World, as the Daleks certainly do.
Superb suggestion. I love it. John, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. I always love having a chance to talk about the most amazing show in the universe.
It certainly is. It's the greatest show in the galaxy, you could say.
Indeed.
Fantastic. Well, we'll be back, in fact, tomorrow as we begin a run of an episode a day. Oh my goodness, people, you're going to have to find at least 40 minutes a day to listen to these episodes. I'm so sorry.
That's what I call dedication.
That's what I call madness and the lack of evenings of late. But
volume 198.
Oh, exactly. And somehow the next vortex is almost finished as well. I don't know how it happened, but there we go. Anyway, over to Tears for Fears. Bye-bye.
Bye.